First of all, let me just give you an idea of some of the things you might be able to do if you wanted to go read something. The bookstore has this book, which is very useful to talk about conversation. And you may have heard of this author because she's a linguist who can write bestsellers, and that's really something. Deborah Tannen, this book, That's Not What I Meant. And it's about conversation and misconversation, or misunderstood conversation. And she talks a lot about conversational strategies and how we use them to communicate. In conversing, it's not just the language, of course, but it's how we use the language that's of interest. Things, you know, are not always what they seem to be, and we sometimes don't say what we mean. You know, otherwise, why would we sometimes say, what do you mean by that? So we'll talk about that as the week goes along. There's another book that, unfortunately, our bookstore doesn't have, and it's a little heavy sometimes, and it's by this Robin Lakoff. It's called Talking Power, the Politics of Language, but there's some interesting things in here, which I will come back to when I start talking about language in the courtroom. Here's a linguist who got called to jury duty, and she sort of chronicles the whole experience and how the discussion in the courtroom worked, and how, on the other hand, the discussion in the jury room worked, which were two different things, two different forms of persuasion. I can mention a couple of other books, which you may not be able to find. This one's a Canadian book, Jay Ingram's Talk, 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 which is it's not the script, but it's sort of a summary of a series of radio programs he did. He's a science editor for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation and now does a TV show. But he did a whole series on language. And it is a Penguin book, but it's a very good sort of quick run through the garden as far as linguistic topics go. Again, our bookstore doesn't have it. They tried to get it. I think that's because it comes out of Toronto. And here's a book, unless there's a second edition, I know you won't be able to find because it comes from 1974, but it's still the best one on this topic in my book, and it's called Language and Woman's Place, again by Robin Lakoff. In those days, she was married to another linguist named George Lakoff. And she said, it's funny how when they refer to paper written by Lakoff, they mean him, not me. those are just a few books. And if you're really curious about linguistics, I can tell you a whole lot more. But unfortunately, linguists don't write very well. For all they know about language, and you have to be careful what it is you pick up. So, anyway, you may have heard about Noam Chomsky, perhaps the only author I've ever read that reads better in a translation to another language than in English. Anyway, we have to read a lot of his stuff as he turns it out. Well, I want to go through a little bit of an overview today, and I'll ask you a few questions, and we'll try to get some discussion going, but I think the real fireworks will fly starting tomorrow. First of all, you all know a language. You wouldn't be here. I assume all of you know English pretty well. How many of you started out in life speaking some other language besides English or along with English? Anybody have a second language or another language at home? Even a grandma language? Or... No?
My parents spoke Norwegian fluently.
Did you speak Norwegian with them?
They had 11 kids, and that was their...
Oh, wow. Tell you what happened there. All the kids spoke English.
Yeah, they liked it that way.
And one boy, I heard German and Swiss, because, but although my father spoke German, he was born in San Francisco, and my mother spoke Swiss, German Swiss, but she was born in San Francisco. And again, we prayed in German, and we even heard sermons in German until the time of the war, and then they switched to English. And but it wasn't, I didn't know the language. Indeed, I wish I had paid much closer attention to it. I was the sixth child down the ladder, and it wasn't spoken at home other than between the adults for private or secret or don't let the kids hear it. That's right. And then later I lived in Germany and wished I had paid attention. Then I had to study it.
Why did you wish then you had paid attention?
Because I was found myself living in Germany.
Yeah, but wasn't it, didn't it come easy?
Much easier.
Not as easy. I would not now say I speak German. I know a certain amount.
Why do you suppose it's so critical what language is spoken at home?
Because it influences the children, of course.
Because you learn best from your
home. Yeah, you ever watched a little child learning language? About an 18-month-old? Sometimes they get on to, what's that? What that? What at? They're just like a sponge soaking it up.
And it's interesting. I had a somewhat close relationship with a Vietnamese family for a while, and while I knew them, they learned to speak English, and they had children here, so naturally their children were learning English. However, they brought some of their parents over from Vietnam at one time after that, and when the parents came, I watched this little child, and she spoke just as fluently with her parents and her siblings in English, and she spoke Vietnamese with her grandparents, and she seemed to know exactly which language she should use at home. It's interesting.
I had an interesting experience like that with the children. I had a niece who cared for a little Lebanese boy, and his parents were going to college, and he spoke. His father brought him one morning and told my niece that he was very excited. This little boy had said an English word, and at home, at his home. And Elaine didn't understand the excitement. She said, well, yes, of course. And this little kid knew the two languages, Arabic and English, and kept them totally separate.
Yeah.
He spoke perfect English at my niece's house and Arabic.
Well, children have an amazing ability that we don't have. In fact, when children begin learning a language, it just seems to blossom very quickly. And it can be said, in fact, that children who learn a language natively can become what is essentially a linguistic adult by age 5. And then it's downhill. And if you've ever tried to learn languages at about age 18 and later, you know, it becomes hard work. And you have to rely on all kinds of crutches like books and repetition. You know, ever have your vocabulary lists? You had to go over and over and over and over again, but you watch a little 18-month-old find out the name of something, and they've got it just like that. And there seems to be a natural process of maturation that sort of opens the airwaves for receptiveness to language at a certain point. And it happens in every child universally. It doesn't matter what language or even languages they're exposed to. They're going to latch onto those languages. And it happens very quickly, astonishingly quickly. We think, you know, that there's a certain kind of baby talk, that there's a phase, for example, when you can hear that children are speaking in two-word sentences. They'll say, "All gone, Daddy," when Daddy goes to work, or bye-bye sock when you throw it in the wash, or something like that. All these little two-word things. But if you analyze them, you find out that they have a very organized structure. And what the child is doing over this time is, in fact, discovering the organization of the grammar of that particular language in a way that doesn't use any sort of visual aids or tools or tape recorders or anything else that we might need later in life when we're trying to learn a language. So it's something that's driven by the way people develop, the way they grow up. And it seems to be on a kind of a clock. And that clock kicks in, and the process of learning the language starts. And then it tapers off gradually until, well, when you're an older teenager, it starts to be a lot more work. But children have that amazing ability to do two or even more languages at once. Sometimes they get into difficulty with three or more. I knew a case of twins who were Dutch. They spoke Dutch and English at home and went to school in German. One of the twins did fine with all three, but one of them just rejected German. And they ended up sending that child home to Holland for schooling there, because she just was not coping with the third language. That happens sometimes, but with two languages, particularly if one's identified with one parent, one with the other, there seems to be no problem. They talk to one parent, one language, switch over, and talk maybe about the same thing in another language to the other parent. Yeah. Just automatic.
Well, it's that the niece married a Spaniard and raised the children in Spain, and he taught the kids in Spanish and she in English. Mm-hmm. Even though the parents knew both languages, but he did that to teach them both languages, and then they sent them to a French school.
Now, one of the things about the way children learn language, and this illustrates a point, that the children are not really conscious of this, and they're not consciously being taught. We don't sit down in the morning with our two-year-old and say, well, it's time for your English lesson. They just do it along the way. And the ability to switch in conversation between languages seems automatic. But if you look at even the way we talk, there are so many things in conversation that are automatic. Figuring out when it's my turn to talk, for example. You have different ways of signaling, you know, I'm about to be finished. And then so the other person starts gearing up. And we have end-to-end sentences as we have conversations. You know, only if there's some difficulty in processing information do you get these gaps where, you know, it's sometimes called awkward silences, where things don't flow. And when we are talking, we're not thinking about it. We're not consciously concentrating on it, unless, of course, you get put up in front of a big audience and then you start doing what we call monitored speech, where you're listening carefully to yourself. The interesting thing is that you do that anyway. That is, unconsciously, you're always monitoring what you're saying to make sure you actually said what you intended to say. But you're not conscious of that. It's just when you really want to concentrate on what it is you're saying, make sure you don't make any bloopers, that you start sort of tuning in to that little loop that's going in your head that's listening to what it is you're saying. So, what's really remarkable about language is everybody uses it all the time, every day, but scarcely ever thinks about it. And so that's part of our problem this week, is trying to bring that all in the foreground and learning to think about language and make some observations, whereas we don't normally sort of step outside of it and make observations. Now that's going to put you all on your toes. And you're going to start, oh, what did I just say, you know? Start thinking about them. But that can be interesting too, as you begin to think about language and how you use it and how things actually work. That's different than just using it. And that's what linguists do most of the time, is observe and analyze and so forth. And we spend a lot of time in graduate school training to do that. So we have sort of like a second channel going all the time. And I know some linguists always keep a piece of paper in their pocket. And all of a sudden someone will be talking, they whip that piece of paper, write something down, and put it back because they heard something that really tickled them. So what we, by the way, the way we should work here, since we have an hour and a half, is I think we'll go for about 40 minutes and then take about a 10-minute break and then go for another 40 minutes. How's that? My jaw gets tired after 40 minutes. So the interesting thing now that if we think about it is that there aren't any other critters, even the more intelligent apes, that work quite like we do in this sense. We don't see any of this kind of compulsion in the small offspring of, say, the chimpanzees or the gorillas to go out and find and acquire a language. We have had some, I know my dog knows when I tell him, go get your frisbee. You know, and if you've ever seen that Gary Larson cartoon about what dog owners say, and you know, it's a nice long conversation, and the dog's name is Ginger, right? And then the other part of it is what dogs hear, and it's a bunch of gobbledygook and the word ginger, you know. And I'm sure all he hears about when I say go get your frisbee is frisbee, but he looks all over the house and gets it, and he's ready to go out the door. And to some extent, you can say that dog understands English. There have been some efforts to teach higher apes, gorillas, and chimpanzees things like sign language or how to manipulate little plastic symbols on a magnetic board to make communications of some kind. And they seem to achieve a fairly high level in that they will have some 700, 800, 900 different kinds of communication that they can make back and forth. But if you think about a language like English, 700, 800, 900 isn't very much. You think about the average novel and how many sentences it's got in it. And I suspect if you opened up any thick, reasonably thick novel to any particular page, put your finger on a sentence, the chances are pretty good you never saw that sentence before. So many times, the communications that we go back and forth are entirely new to us, yet we understand them. So we have a system for understanding them. We don't have a list memorized. These are the 200,000 sentences of English, and if you know those, that's all you need to know. It doesn't work that way. In fact, let's say I made up a sentence right now. Wes Priebe is Holden's pool hall director. I suspect at least some of you have never heard that sentence before. But it refers to a particular person. How many of you met Wes? Yes, well, you'll have to do that while you're here this week.
I heard it, but I heard it you talking.
We had a conversation this morning at
breakfast. Anyway, that refers to a particular person, a particular job, and it uses a name and some words of English. Now, you may not know who Wes Priebe is, but you know something about him now, and you know there is a person by that name you could go find and meet. So, using entirely familiar things, that is familiar to any speaker of English, we can create entirely new sentences to say, or new messages to send, and so we have this enormous variety of things we can say to each other. Which is probably good, because we'd get boring real fast if we didn't. So every human child learns a language. Now there are some cases in history where children have been deprived of the kind of surroundings you need to pick up that language. There are cases of children who have been locked away. There were some, I think, in the 16th century, some instances in England. There was one noted case called Jeannie in Los Angeles about 20 or 25 years ago, where it was an extreme abusive situation. The child was kept locked for several years in an attic or a closet. And the child got old enough that it was no longer possible for her to learn a language as if she were a small child. That is, aside from all the emotional disturbance, which also was a factor, she never developed a full language and has been studied very extensively because of this. It's a very unusual case. But humans universally do this. So this is one of the traits of human language. It's universal in our species. And it's the other thing is it's specific to us. It's not characteristic of other species. Although they have communication systems, they can even take a limited set of communications in a human-like language, they still can't comprehend the entire thing, like an entire language, English or Swahili or whatever. So this is, that's okay, that's not for us. We have about 5 more minutes in this section and then we'll take a little break. What we have done, and we'll get to this after the break. Over the years, we sort of accumulated, a list of specifications. If you wanted to have a human language, what would it have to do? What would its capabilities be? We call them the design features of language. If you were some sort of linguistic engineer and you wanted to go out and invent one, what would you need? They include such things as, our ability to talk about things that aren't here. This is something that's very interesting about animal communication systems. We can talk about Aunt Matilda in Spokane. And if you look at, screech monkeys, for example. They quite clearly have a communication system. They scream their heads off. You ever run into some in the zoo? They always attract a crowd because they sit there and they just squeal and screech and carry on. And those cries have meaning for them. They have a limited repertoire of them. I guess the major thing about them is they can be heard for over a mile. Which, if you live in the top of jungle trees, it's important if your relatives are, several trees away, you need to be heard. But one of the obvious uses of their cries is danger, right? So they have one call that means danger. And for each of their little calls, there's some association. Except they don't use that unless they are triggered by a dangerous situation. So the danger has to be present. They don't sit around and make the thing and say, I was really talking about the one that happened last week. but we do that. We talk about things that went on some other time or some other place. So that's the kind of thing that sets some of the things that we do apart from animal communication systems. Of course, there are many different kinds of animal communication systems. The bees even have one. But the important thing is, if we take all this list that we're going to go through, there aren't any animal communication systems that have them all. Some of them have a few of these things, but they don't get it all together the way the humans do. So why don't we just take our 10-minute break at that point, and we'll come back and take a look at that list. You sure can. That's what 10 minutes is for. It's 5 minutes up and 5 minutes back. Oh, that's fine. Oh, that's great. Yeah, because we don't want... quickly go through some of these design features. They may at the beginning seem a little abstract. I'll try to give you examples, but I hope as we go through some of the other things we'll be able to pick up on some of them or you'll recognize them again. I think the first thing we have to notice about language as we see it across all civilizations is that the primary mode of language is speech. It's oral. There are languages which have no writing. But there are currently no living languages that are written that don't have speech. So that's the primary mode, and that's the way language must have been invented. And but except that I must say that I include signing with that. Consider signing to be a form of speech. And there is some discussion now about the origins of language perhaps being a combination of a kind of signing as well as these utterances that we use our mouths for. And one of the reasons for that is that some form of sign language is almost universal. We talk in North America about Indian Sign Language, but sign languages are found around the world, and they are traditional forms of sign language of some kind, as well as the ones that are more formal and more adapted to the hearing impaired. The use of language. Did you have a question? Yes,
yeah,
interrupt me anytime.
Though, the language development is being able to hear.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because that is so important.
That's right.
To speak, you have to hear.
Absolutely.
Language development in children, of course, is much different if the children can't hear. It's interesting that some of the early signs of development of language begin to emerge in children, but when they start not in getting the feedback that they need, they sort of die out. And then we have to use alternative methods of teaching them to speak. And you're all probably familiar with the Helen Keller story and how difficult that is to break through that silence and actually teach someone to speak when they can't hear themselves. Language is also directional. That is, it's not symmetrical. I can talk and you can listen, and then you can talk and I can listen, but we don't sort of go online at the same time. So this implies that when we have conversations, there's turn-taking, hopefully. And the other thing when we're talking about speech, of course, it's transitory. Right? I know people who are constantly taking notes. but you know, you get one shot at some comment unless you say, I didn't hear that. Would you repeat that? It's fleeting. And so we have equipment in here that first the ears and then some mental processing that tries to capture the sense of what was said. Then we stuff it into our memory, and if you think about a conversation, you know, you have to remember what you started out talking about at the beginning, so you can make sense of the whole thing, and you come to a conclusion there. So this is part of the problem of conversation and speech, is that we have to coordinate all of this talk stuff with memory and all of these things, so there's a lot of what I would call translation going on from the actual speech into this system of making sense of what it is we're talking about and where we want to get and what conclusions we want to draw. That is the logic of all of what's going on here.
What causes you to start talking and then you'll say, oh no, what was I getting at? Yeah. Is that lack of concentration?
It may be. It may be a simple overload that you have had so many things running around in your head, and you have like a cue, you know, because this comes one after the other. You have a thought queued up, and it kind of just spills out the end, and then you turn it on, and then something comes out and say, oh, whoops, I lost my trace there. In most of the things we talk about, there's usually some sort of condition, a pathological condition that mirrors this sort of thing, and the victims of stroke often illustrate many of these things. And there is a form of damage. It can be from stroke or from brain injury of some kind, where people are just as fluid as they were before, but it makes no sense, and they have no ability to organize what it is they want to say. There are other kinds of injury where it's the reverse, where, and this is a different area of the brain that gets injured, they know what it is they want to say, but it's extremely frustrating. They cannot get it out. They get out a few words, and And it's very difficult. It's very telegraphic, the kind of speech that they're able to put together. So it's a very complex process of mental organization, verbal organization, monitoring what you said, all of these things working together to make sense out of what comes out of your mouth. And sometimes it still doesn't make sense, even as hard as you work. We talked about it being directional, but notice that each of us both receive and transmit. It isn't that some of us are receivers and others are transmitters, although in some situations it may seem like that. We have both capabilities. In some animal communication systems, only certain specialized members of the group get to be transmitters. In the bee language, you know, it's the workers who come back and transmit the location of the pollen and honey to the others by doing their little bee dance in the hive. And then the other bees go out and find it according to the directions they were given. Have any of you ever seen movies of that? It's really, really quite something. They're able to describe the distance and direction of a source of pollen and honey by the way that they buzz back and forth and wag their tails. The speed at which they do it and so forth gives the others a fix on where the source is. As I said, sure.
Fix that curtain down.
Oh, yes. The sun. How are we doing on windows there?
We closed them.
Yeah, in the afternoon it'll be the opposite thing when the sun's streaming in. Mm-hmm. Actually, no, this is fairly early in the year. Maybe it won't be so bad as it is in August. I also mentioned we're self-monitoring. We're able to listen to ourselves and if we need to, correct ourselves. There are a lot of animal communication systems where they don't listen to themselves. They just produce something for others. This typical sort of danger cry and so forth. I mean, there's just one squawk you put out. You don't have to listen to see whether that was the right one or not. When you only have four or five things in your repertoire, you just, you know, it's like hitting a key on the piano and out it comes. The interesting thing about the way we communicate is that we generally use organs that are for breathing and eating. And what we've done is we've added a new specialization to the teeth, lips, tongue, larynx, and so forth. All those things were there before. They had other functions, and we've just sort of overlaid this language function on it. The same way that our hands are really for something else, but we still gesture with them and use them for communication as well. Now we'll get into some more real linguistic things. One of the things we're able to do with words, in particular, is to denote things. That is, if I tell you there is a person named Wes Priebe, then I am referring to a specific person. We can also denote things in general. I can talk about tables, for example. We have one word, and it indicates something in the real world. It points to something. You can use the word table to point to this thing over there, and one of those over there, and so forth. So words have what we call a denotation. They can be used to refer to something. The interesting thing about names, like Wes Priebe, is that's all they do, is they refer to something. But a word like table also has, aside from being able to refer to this table or to that table, also for us has something in it, a meaning that in a sense describes tables. That is, we know a table when we see one because we know what the word table means. And so that's a very important thing about our language as opposed to, let's say, the cry of alarm of a screech monkey, which doesn't denote anything in particular. It just is a very practical a warning. We may use a word that denotes something as a warning or as a cry of delight or something else, but we don't have to. We have other things that don't denote something. There are lots of utterances we use that don't denote anything. They just express something or emotive, like yow or ouch or ugh, something like that. But most of our vocabulary, I wouldn't call ouch vocabulary, but our vocabulary denotes something. It has something that we can distill into a kind of meaning. Another thing about language, and in particular the words we use, is that it's pretty arbitrary what we pick to denote something. So there is nothing about the word dog that suggests four-legged furry creatures that bark. And in fact, in German, they call them a Hund, which is quite different. There are no series of sounds that in some way evoke the idea of dogs, right? We can pick any, we could decide to call them a splurg, for example, just if we got everybody to agree that that'd be what we call them from now on, we could use it. So the words that we use and the particular things that have particular meanings, we can just arbitrarily pick them out. And in fact, that's what Lewis Carroll did when he wrote things like Jabberwocky. He just picked nonsense words. 'Twas brillig and the slithy toads, you know. Just a bunch of arbitrary words. They sure sound like English, don't they? Another aspect of the way we talk, and we've been talking about words, and words are a good example of another property that our languages have, and that's discreteness. They're chopped up into little pieces. The words themselves are pieces we can put together into bigger things called sentences. That is, they're building blocks. And if you look inside the words, like dog, it consists of three sounds. Again, there are pieces we can chop it into. If you look at a word that has, say, an ending on it, like dogs, right? There are two pieces there. There's one dog, and then there's another z, the end, which indicates something else. It has its own meaning. So this discreteness means we have building blocks, and this helps us to achieve this kind of complexity that we have, where we can keep stringing things in longer and longer and longer. Well, you know the little ditty about this is the house that Jack built, and so forth. It just keeps getting longer and longer and longer. And in fact, you might ask the question, in principle, what is the longest sentence in English? It'd be difficult to tell, because you could always add one more phrase, you know? We've mentioned displacement. That is, we can talk about things in other times and other places. Another thing that's very striking with our language, and English is real good at this, and that's the openness or extensibility of the language. We don't have a word for something, we make one up, or we borrow one, or steal one, or something. You can always make the language, you can adapt the language to fit new situations. So when somebody invented a Xerox machine, they said, "What is that thing?" "Well, I call it a Xerox machine," and that's what it was. The language is flexible in the sense that it responds to the needs of people who want to talk and use it. And so if you don't find what you need, you can adapt it in some way to do whatever it is you need. Another aspect of human languages is that there is a duality. That is, there are two things that are going on at the same time. We are talking using sound, but as we just talked about, in the background, in our heads, there's something else going on. We call it meaning. And what we do when we speak is we pair up some meaning, that is something you intend to say, with a sound. And then the person on the other end can hear that and decode it and say, aha, that's what they meant. That is, if you're successful. there are those situations where it's not entirely clear and you say, what did you mean by that? And so much of linguistics is involved with studying this business of how we get particular meanings paired up with particular sounds. Now, on the word level, it's fairly easy. Dog, we know what that means. That denotes four-footed furry animals that bark. But when you get into more abstract things and start talking about more exotic stuff like theology or something, you can sit and break your head over what it might mean and try to figure it out. Another thing that you have to think about that we do that animals don't is that we lie. The screech monkey doesn't give out the danger call and then say, oh, just fooling. The first one that would try that would probably get thrown right out of the tree. But unfortunately, we do that all the time. You know, we don't say what we mean, and sometimes it's intentional. Another thing that we do with language, and we're doing right now, at least I am so far, and that's reflexiveness. That is, we're reflecting on language itself. We not only use language, but we talk about it. And we can think about it. And that's what we're going to try to do this week, is start thinking about language and not just sort of using it and ignoring what it is. We'll try to bring it out of the background. And the last thing that's of importance is that it's a learnable system. That is, we can learn it. We've said we learn it real easy when we're little. But we can learn it when we're adults, too. It just takes more work. And if you look at all the different things we do with our brains, math, weaving, all those kinds of activities, we have this enormous capacity to learn things. And language is something that we can learn, too. In fact, although I said children become linguistic adults at about age 5, one thing that we do in school is we don't really learn the basics of the language anymore. What we do is we elaborate it. We learn to read it. We learn to write it. We learn to use passive sentences. I mean, people don't use those in conversation, and 5-year-olds don't use them, but, you know. We use much more elaborate, longer constructions, and we learn to do that in school. And so there's a long process of learning involved with language, and we probably still learn stuff every day, a little bit, about our language, unless we don't do much talking. Even if it's just a fine nuance on a familiar old word, someone uses it in a slightly different way. So we're always learning something linguistic. So that's the rundown on sort of the specifications of a language, and we just want to keep those in the background as we go on. What we're going to be concentrating on in the next few days is how, or what kind of role our language plays, first in our social interactions, talking to one another, those relationships that we're always in, you know. Relationships, as we say, don't work without communication. Our primary form of communication is linguistic. Even people who sign, they are using language, right? It doesn't have to be oral. It can be signed or written. Think of those sort of cases of people who meet as pen pals and carry on a correspondence and finally get on the plane and rush to each other's arms. You know, that it was still language that mediated that relationship. And that's very important to us. And the other aspect of this is the kind of cumulative of all the relationships in a particular society develops what we refer to as a culture. And one of the things that we do with culture is remember it. And it's something that's passed on. the next generations teach. And the important medium of that transmission is language. There are some cultures who still rely entirely on spoken operating instructions, if you want, entirely oral cultures where all the knowledge that they have is passed on by telling stories. And I think it's, in fact, it's kind of sad that we don't rely that much on those things anymore. We don't sit out on the porch and have grandpa tell stories the way they used to. And so, what's the great storyteller now? Boy, isn't it amazing how people jump on that one right away? No doubt, is there? And it's particularly tragic for cultures that have been oral cultures when TV comes along, and instead of being grandparents telling the stories, it's the satellite dish. And that brings a very abrupt interruption into the sort of normal course of things as far as that culture is concerned. Not that it hasn't been abrupt for us, too, you know. We've been suffering with TV for a long time. The 50s, anyway. Now, I guess what's important about that is that aside from sort of managing our personal relationships with language, communication, there's a lot of cultural identity tied up in our language. We are not just North Americans, you know, but we happen to be the English-speaking ones. And so that, in a sense, defines a lot of what it is we do every day. To some groups, particularly ones that are very small, that cultural identity is very important. It's sort of their uniqueness. We don't have a sense of that because so many people speak English. For people who speak Danish, however, it's kind of like one of the, you know, this is who I am. I'm one of those people who speaks Danish, among other things. So I'd like to be able to come back in a couple of days and look at those issues of cultural identity, because they're extremely important, both within a society and then, I think, in the global context where cultural identity begins to be tied up with national identity and the whole issue of politics. And, you know, there has been more than one civil war waged over language issues. There are plenty of them in the history of Africa, for example. There are other instances where political problems have been solved by careful linguistic arrangements. After World War II, the Scandinavian countries, for example, formed several large corporations among themselves, Scandinavian airline systems, a couple of import-export banks, and so forth. And of course, they had the perennial problem. Well, will we speak Norwegian, Danish, Swedish, or what? Of course, nobody was going to give in on that, so what do you think they speak? English, of course. Pick somebody else's language. So, it turns out for many peoples, and we can apply this to ourselves to some extent, although it's not quite as easy to put our finger on anymore, is that your inheritance in cultural terms is your story. That is, the things that you can tell about where you came from, who you belong to, and so forth. How many of you have had the opportunity to do that in your own families, where you have an idea of your family history and where people have handed down some of the stories about families? I know that's sort of going away, isn't it? I was very happy when my parents-in-law began writing down some of the family stories and giving them each Christmas to the kids in these binders, you know, so they have a little collection of them. Maybe someday they'll take them out and find out what it was like, you know. But that's all part of this transmission of our culture. Now we have so many information sources, we have so many ways of bringing this information forward in time, that we don't have those identifiable sort of paths or routes that we hand down this information. We have huge libraries full of this stuff. I mean, you can look up things now. So people aren't concerned about acquiring this stuff, say, when they're children. They say, well, I can always go look it up, you know. Somebody's got our genealogy somewhere. Somebody's got, you know, where this town came from, down written down in the history, and so forth. So they don't concern themselves with it so much. We're going to talk about this particularly with respect to some of the native peoples that live in this area and other parts of the world, and how their sense of identity is really tied up to what they can remember and what stories they have, because they never had a written history. We are quite different in that we have this law. I mean, we can go, if you're Lutheran, you can go back to the origins of the whole church, you know. If you are practicing one of the native religions from around here, nobody can tell you about the beginning of it, but they can tell you some of the stories that belong to that religious practice. However, if people stop speaking the language, then nobody remembers the stories anymore.
Yeah. It has to do with salt. If you hear a story, somebody tells you, your past or their past, your parents' past, somehow stays better than if you just read it.
Or hear it on TV.
It becomes more personal.
Yeah, it's not true. They said that bonding takes place, listening on the self, and feeding on the emotion to the soul of it rather than just on the part. I think that's important. I do think we're missing something in our generation. Not to have the time to sit and listen to one another.
If you look at, for example, the TV, it's impersonal and it's passive, right? You know, we tune out the TV sometimes, commercial comes on, off goes the switch. But if someone is telling you a story about, say, your family, then actually you become part of the story. Where, you know, this is the story down to me, and now I'm continuing the story on. And that's a different situation, where people become directly involved in what's going on. And in some of the cultures I've worked in the Northwest here, there's very much a sense of stories being family heirlooms, and that you can't really know a story completely unless it's actually been given to you. And I have had cases where Native people have been telling me stories, and then they get almost to the end and they stop. And I said, well, do you know the end of the story? Yeah. Are you going to tell me? No. I said, well, why? Well, my grandfather died before he could give me the rest of the story. So it's not mine to tell.
Dances are the same way. The Indian dances are...
Yes, the dances are property as well. Yeah, they have a very clear idea of what we would call intellectual property. And I know that in one village, they had given away a dance to a neighboring village of another tribe, 50 years ago or something. And they were so delighted that they had a powwow and this other tribe decided to be real friendly and do something for them. They gave the dance back, and they were just all so happy that it went. Because you see, once you give it away, you can't dance it anymore. It's not yours. So they've really had a sense of ownership of things like that. And so when something was transmitted to you, you felt like, you know, you'd been entrusted with something. And all of these things are, you know, these are customs. Then they're either music or dance, or they are words. They're spoken language. And many of those people are now trying to write all of those things down before, as happened with this one woman. You know, the things are not given on anymore. And that's, I think, we have to need to think about the process of transmission of our culture. It's very much based on language, even though the TV may now take part in it. You know, TV is language-based. It isn't just pictures. And in a sense, we now build up storehouses of our cultural identity. And, you know, in a place like North America here, we can see an enormous diversity. We have a number of different cultural traditions living side by side. And so each one of those, the representatives of those different groups, has different ways of trying to preserve their culture. And so, for example, a particular ethnic group might decide to live together so they can have stores and, say, religious meeting places and so forth in one place where they can sort of keep everything together. Because otherwise you sort of get diffused all over the place and it just sort of trickles away, and the dominant culture that comes through the TV wire and so forth begins to take over, because you don't have that focus of a particular culture that permits you to continue those traditions. When we talk about our social interactions, we're going to talk about the business of independence on the one hand, and involvement on the other. And when we talk to each other, we're trying to balance these things, right? We want to be involved and have good communication with someone. Yet we want to maintain our independence. We don't want to become so involved that the other person sort of takes over and dominates us. You can look at the cultures that way too. That we may have in one society a number of different cultures, and of course they want to be involved. But, you know, if it's one political unit, they want to be involved in the whole business of running the country or whatever. But they want to maintain their independence. And unfortunately, there are many political disputes and even wars that erupt over this business of balancing the involvement and the independence. And I think the present situation in Yugoslavia is probably a good example. Right? They all want involvement to the point where the others are absorbed in them or something like that, and they're not willing to allow a balance of independence. So it's become a very sticky situation. It's hard to see how you can resolve that sort of thing. But think, that's perhaps, since we're coming up here with only a few minutes left, that's something you might think about for tomorrow. It's not entirely a linguistic issue, but think about how in your personal relationships and in specific in your conversations, how this involvement and independence works. There are many conversational situations that you get into. Take an example. One person has an issue that they find important. Let's say my wife, for example. She might be concerned with the schedule for the day, right? It's breakfast, and we've got kids to take to basketball practice, and there's groceries to get, all the, you know, just a whole list of things that need to be done. And I'm not concerned about it at all. In fact, I'm reading the paper. you know, in fact, she accuses me sometimes of just saying, every once in a while, just to let her know I'm behind there and make sure that the conversation goes on. There you can see there are different levels of involvement. And me with my newspaper, I'm trying to preserve my independence. And my wife, of course, will be concerned about getting a little more involvement out of me. And so, you know, this interplay goes on all the time. So that's your assignment, if you want. Think about those ideas of involvement and independence and how they play out in our interactions and specifically our conversations. And we have a couple of minutes left if you want to pick up on anything or ask any questions. Yes.
This is neither here nor there, but you mentioned Xerox, and we were living in Rochester when they developed that. And they got that for the, they wanted a name like Kodak because George Eastman had named Kodak, and it ended one letter and ended another.
Yeah.
Became most famous commercial.
Mm-hmm.
So they chose a name that ended, started with one letter and ended it with the same letter.
Yep.
They deliberately made that.
You name. Invent things and. Well, if you invent the machine, people are going to ask you, what do you call it?
Yeah.
And it sticks.
I'm kind of interested in how words are created, because when you look back the last 20 years, I mean, there's words we use today that weren't even around.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like the younger generation are usually the ones that contribute to this. Is that always the case?
The younger generation are very important. In doing that, there are various ways of inventing words. You can just make them up, like Xerox. Or you can take another word and use it in a new way. Or you can take pieces of words and put them together in a new way. There are various methods. The young generation is very important in making innovations in language, but the interesting thing is they don't become visible for about 20 years. Typically, what will happen is there will be generational talk, say teenagers will talk a certain way, but it won't really influence, let's say, the language in general until they get to be about 35, and they're still talking that way.
Right. Okay.
And they have, well, economic power, political power, and they are in positions of influence in all areas, education and so forth. And then they become sort of mainstream standard folks, not just those teenagers, you know. And there are specific items you can trace, and people have done this out of the 60s, you know, like rip off for steal. That when, you know, Jerry Rubin and the like turned 35, that was a fairly common way of saying steal, to rip something off. But I remember when it was, you know, an innovation.
Somebody published a list of correct words like that, and the Los Angeles riots they had and the looting,
yeah.
They call it unconventional shopping.
Alternative.
I mean, that's the one I remember. There was a whole list.
Yes. Alternative requisitioning, yes. There's a question over here.
Well, I was going to say about language development, I think our genetics and our personalities make a little difference, too, in how the language develops. Just noticing the difference in our children, how very different they were in beginning to talk. Our brightest kid didn't talk till he was well past two. And then it was full sentences. He didn't say one word.
It reminds me of the story of the child who didn't speak. And the parents were worried, and they took him to doctors, and he was 4 years old and still hadn't said a word, and then came 5 years old, still wasn't speaking, and the specialist had examined him and so forth. And one day at lunch he said, "This soup is too damn hot." And they were astonished, you know, and they said, "My goodness, you mean you could talk all this time and you haven't said anything?" And well, he said, "Everything's been all right up to now." But that's true. Children have different inclinations about speech. The interesting thing is that although genetically there are quite wide variations, and in fact people are more verbal than others sometimes, the interesting thing is they acquire the language in the same way and in the same sequence. It may be at a different pace or a different time, but the method of acquiring it seems to be the same. The amount, say, of feedback that a child needs might differ a lot, like the child who didn't talk to him because, you know, soup was too hot, that they just sort of absorb it. They don't need to, you know, have the back and forth sort of communication. Others are constantly, I mean, they just talk your ear off. Have you ever run into those little toddlers who will just yak up a storm? Others, they work quite differently.
Tom, yeah. That joke you just told is almost true, because the daughter I told you about earlier who absorbed Korean so well, I have a number of children. I have 7 children. She did not speak till she was nearly 4 years old. We were very concerned. She jabbered, and she had a sister 13 months older than she. They had a language of their own.
Yes.
They spoke constantly. It became such that we would have to ask the older girls, what did Shelley say? This is true. She, you know, she interpreted. Of course, we brought the younger one to the doctor. It's true she had an adenoid and she had to have tonsils out. And he said she has to go to nursery school, kindergarten. She has to be with other children because she was too much with this close sister.
Yeah.
And she was very late in speaking, but then she's the child that first absorbed English, then we were living in Germany and she absorbed German, then we lived in Korea and she absolutely absorbed Korean and retains them. You know, she learned them, but she was certainly slow to start off.
It's interesting that there are several very closely studied cases of twins who develop what they call a twin language, where they will have their own little way of speaking to each other, and only they understand each other. And that sounds like a very close situation like that.
We have that situation with our grandchildren, too. The older child is 6, and the younger one is 2, and he hardly speaks at all except to her. And she translates everything. So mm-hmm. I understand. They'll say, what does he want, or what's he want? Oh, well, Jonathan wants blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it makes sense. It's not, doesn't Jonathan want soup or something?
Yeah.
Explaining what Jonathan was saying.
It's like those official translators sometimes, you know, that the president speaks for 5 minutes and the translator says 2 words, and then the president says 2 words and then the translator gives a 10-minute speech. Yeah.
Do you speak some of the Native American dialects?
I don't really speak them very well, but I do most of my work on paper. I have some colleagues who are very good speakers of some of them. In fact, they may be the best speakers of some of those languages that are left. But they've been working on them for 20 or 25 years.
I imagine you've been up to Nia Bay. They're doing a lot of work with the Indians.
No, I haven't been there. I have met people who worked there and heard them speak about their work.
They have a wonderful center there now.
Yeah.
They're doing a lot of work and trying to teach the children the stories. And
we're spread pretty thin, people who are doing this work. Yeah. The vineyards are many and the workers are few.
Well, the Indians are doing this themselves.
Yes, yeah.
Are they then translating this into a written language so that...
Yes, most of them are developing an alphabet that they can write. And most of the Northwest languages have a written form now. They have alphabets. And some of them have been written for over 100 years. So that, you know, some of the more notable ones like Kwakwala and Haida and so forth.
Coffee time?
10 o'clock. Oh yes, a little past even. If you have one of the hearing enhancers, we're supposed to leave them on the table over here, I guess. Well, I guess if you're going on at 10:30, you can keep yours.
The Indian tribe in Alert Bay, they were Kwakute.
They're Kwakute.
Kwakute. Say it again.
Kwakute.
Kwakute?
Yeah.
Kwakute.
Kwakute.
Oh, Kwaku.
Yeah.
Okay.
But their language is called Kwakwala.
Kwakwala. Okay. I thought that would be the same language. We spent a week at another hostel at Lark Bay and visited the Indians and the museums and the.
Yeah. Saucers. One of the colleagues in my department is the virtually the expert, the Anglo expert on their language. He's just finishing his huge dictionary. It's about 500, 600 pages long.
And yeah, very progressive.
He's been working. He's been working on this for 20 years. It's a huge, huge amount of work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can
imagine.
Well,
okay.
I have to share an anecdote.
Okay.
I was going to your newspaper and your wife. I found myself in a London, little London hotel. Mostly British people, wasn't a lot of Americans. And there was a little table for two. And then there was me right here, so I was sort of at breakfast with him, but I wasn't, you know. I was just right there. And he was reading the paper and she was on. He put the paper down there and said, really? Yeah. I still remember that. With his mouth turned down, it's only the British do. And then the paper went up with his hands.
However, you have to send that every time. Keep in contact.
Hey.
I wrote one word on the
book. I'm just looking for an eraser, not to erase
I paper. Think we have to go find a paper towel or something.
Okay.
I don't think the bookstore has been able to get this.
Get this, okay. But they do have some of the library might have this.
And then they have this one, and they have another one by the same author on men and women speech.
Oh.
Let's see, which one is that? It's called You Just Don't Understand.
Okay. Yeah.
That one.
Oh, I saw that. Advertised somewhere just recently.
They're very popular books. Mm-hmm.
Oh, this is the one about lady. I mean, this is the one. Lady is a word that interests me very much because I know a couple of women to whom I apply the lady. Usually it's somewhat derisively, but this is in the almost regal sense of the word.
Our congregation, the congregation I belong to, has this thing about the word lady. For some reason, and this is a tradition that started with the church, and it's really not that old church, but we don't have women's groups.
Oh.
We have the ladies of the church.
The ladies, we have women's groups.
And some of the younger ones are all muttering, why can't I be a woman's congregation?
I bet that would draw
I was them. Wondering if there were, I thought you were going to say that there was some kind of spin-off from Our Lady, as the Catholics use it, you know, in that term of.
For some reason that's. The ELW is a ladies group, not Evangelical Lutheran Women, but
Evangelical Ladies.
ELW, and they say that all ladies are invited to participate.
Well,
I suppose if you're not a lady, don't apply.
did ladies just fall out of favor when the women's, the modern women's movement started, or?
No, actually, it's a very fascinating word. It's had a long history of, you know, it has run the gamut from, you know, being a titled woman
a title.
In England to actually fairly derogatory.
To the ladies of the night, the ladies of the street,
right.
Et cetera, yeah.
And it's also a euphemism.
Mm-hmm. Right. I guess that's why.
That's his lady friend.
Right.
You know,
Yeah.
And you want to avoid referring to someone as a woman for some reason.
Right.
Less threatening. So.
Yeah.
There is.
But also that has sort of.